Today's case show will be on case 89 in the Book of Serenity. Case 89 is entitled Dongshan's No Grass. Introduction: move and you bury your body 10,000 feet deep. Don't move. Sprouts grow right where you are. You must cast off both sides and let the middle go. Then you must buy some sandals and travel some more before you really attain realization. Case: Dongshan said to the assembly, "It's the beginning of autumn, the end of summer. You, brethren, you monks, will go, some to the east, some to the west. You must go where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles. He also said, but where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles, how can you go? Shishuang said, going out the gate, immediately there's grass. Dayang said, I'd say, even not going out of the gate, still the grass is boundless. Verse: grass boundless, inside the gate, outside the gate, see by yourself. To set foot in the forest of thorns is easy. To turn the body around, to turn the body outside the luminous screen is hard. Look, look, how many kinds? For the while, going along with the old tree, with the same emaciation in the cold, about to follow the spring wind into the scars of burning. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning. Everybody, many of you came early at 7, and some of you, a large number, came at 8 and some at 9:30, and everybody was sitting very deeply. And thank you for that. That's many hours of uninterrupted practice, everybody really working hard. So it's so wonderful to see that practice. So some of you may be relatively new to Zen, and you may not know much about koans, but koans are Zen stories, usually an exchange between a teacher and a student, or several teachers and a student. In the exchange, there is some presentation of an element of the Dharma, basically, you could say. So often the koans are almost completely impenetrable at first. Some of them are pretty simple. There's a koan that goes, if you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. Some of the koans are really incomprehensible, unless you've done a lot of practice. So, you know, when you encounter a koan like this, it's really asking you to find in your own experience on and off the cushion a way into the koan. So this koan really requires a lot of sitting to penetrate, to be able to access. When I read it, I'm sure it sounded completely, it's like this koan gets the award for being completely incomprehensible. If you've done some sitting, you can begin to see where the koan is taking you. it koan is so impenetrable that it's almost hard to see what the dilemma is, what to focus on. Let me read it one more time. Dongshan said to the assembly, it's the beginning of autumn, the end of summer, and you monks will go, some to the east, some to the west. You must go where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles. So it's the end of the training season. And Dongshan is saying to his monks, okay, we're going to go to the intersession now. It's between semesters. And we're heading into the intersession. And some of you will be going east and some of you will be going west. But wherever you go, you must go where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles. See, that's the main part of the koan. He also said, but where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles, how can you go? And then the rest is just a complication on something that doesn't make sense to begin with. Okay. So, everybody was sitting today really deeply. And often what happens on a Saturday, especially, where we can do extra sitting, but also anytime you do meditation, we have sitting in the morning, we have sitting in the evening. You may, at the end of the day, come to the sit on Monday or Wednesday or Friday nights, and you've had a busy day. Maybe things are troubling you, right? You sit down on the cushion and, you're tense. Tape loops are replaying in your head. And you begin to watch the breath. And after maybe the first sit, you begin to feel a little more calm. Usually about 15 or 20 minutes into a period of meditation, people have a relaxation response. And they begin to feel like they're coming off the ceiling, right? After a hard day, after a stressful day, you get this relaxation response. And then maybe if the meditation period is like 35 minutes, in those last, say, 10 or 15 minutes, you begin to calm the mind itself, right? The thoughts become fewer and farther between, and maybe you're still in those loops, but they're not triggering the same kinds of emotional responses. So then, I ring the bell, and you have a chance to get up and go to the bathroom, and maybe you do some qinyin, you walk around a little bit. Then you come back down and you sit again. And if you haven't been practicing very long, the second sit may be challenging because you don't have the mental focus. But if you've been practicing for a while, on the second sit, it's often the case that your mind begins to slow down and empty out. And in that second sit, you may notice that, things that seem very urgent, very pressing, and emotionally perhaps destabilizing during the earlier part of your day or during your first sit begin to recede. They stop triggering those emotional responses. And the mind stops racing in these circles. You begin to just focus on the breath, or you're focusing on mu-shin, and you're focusing on mu. And your mind begins to calm down and empty out. This is like highly desirable state, depending on what kind of day you've had, what kind of news you've gotten or challenges you've had to face. This is hugely valuable. And it takes a lot of practice to be able to get to this place. A lot of people come in and sit on the cushion and their mind is full of thoughts on the first sit, and the second sit maybe just a little bit less so. But if you keep practicing, you'll begin to get into this state where the mind is still and beginning to be empty, If your practice is watching your breath, you'll notice that as you follow the breath out, when you get to the end of the breath, there's like a little interval there where there's no thought, or it's a little bit blank or empty. And then, you know, you start drawing in the breath again and the thoughts start up again. But every time you breathe out, you empty the mind and you get to this empty place, and then you draw the breath in and thoughts resume, but you keep sort of like emptying the mind out. And if you do this for a while, you know, you'll be able to get into a place that's relatively stable and empty and still. And this feels wonderful. You know, this is a form of samadhi where, you know, you sit down on the cushion, all of a sudden it's like you're in this stable, unchanging or grounded place, and there are very few thoughts in your mind. This takes a while. This takes some real practice, right? As I say, beginners can't get to this state very easily. But if you've been practicing for a while and you come to a few sesshins, and if you do your Saturday meditation where you're building one sit on top of the next, it becomes easier and easier to get into this place. And, you know, you can eventually come in, sit down on the cushion, and you're in this state of deep samadhi, deep stillness, relatively dependably and relatively frequently, right? I mean, so at first, the first time you have an experience of samadhi, it may be quite a shock, you know, to be in that still, imperturbable place. And it's delightful. And then you come in to sit the next time and you're waiting to get to that same place and you can't get there because, you know, your mind is just not accustomed to getting into that place. You know, you just haven't trained yourself enough to get into that place. But eventually, if you keep practicing, you'll get there with some regularity. My teacher, Genki Roshi, I asked, you know, it would take me, in my first couple of years of practice, it would take me a while to get into that state. Sometimes it would take me two sits. So by the end of the second sitting period, I would begin to get into that state of samadhi sort of lightly. And I asked Genki Roshi, I said, how long does it take you to get into samadhi? And he said, I can get into samadhi as soon as I sit down. And he said, I visualize myself as a stick of incense, and the stick of incense is burning from the top down to the ground, and I can feel my body disappearing as I slip into samadhi. Years later, I began to understand what he was talking about. You know, sometimes when you're practiced and you're accustomed to getting into deep samadhi, when you sit down on the cushion, it might feel like parts of your body are disappearing. You might feel like your hands or your face is the only thing left on your body, or maybe your hands, and a lot of your body has simply disappeared. It feels like it's disappeared. You know, and this is like a deep samadhi state. And, you know, Genki Roshi, my teacher, could get there as soon as he hit the cushion. And indeed, you know, I've been doing this for 40 years, so, you know, every sit is deep samadhi for me. You know, at first, it's very difficult to get into this place, right? But with practice, you know, with regular practice and sustained sitting, you can get into samadhi more and more easily. And when you can find this place, it's really wonderful. It's wonderful. So if you haven't found it yet, if you haven't gotten there yet, please keep practicing. You know, eventually you'll be able to get into this sort of like imperturbable, empty state, fairly dependably. And when this happens, it is liberating. It's definitely transformative. You know, so I too have things that happen to me in my job or in my life, and I will be in I'll be very stressed, or I'll be in some emotional distress, you know, And I'll sit down on the cushion and I'll watch my breath and I get into this wonderful samadhi and feel like liberated, right? Feel that I have been set free. This is what, in a way, Dongshan is talking about when he says, it's the beginning of autumn, the end of summer, and you monks will go, some to the east, some to the west. You must go where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles. See? So if you don't know much about Zen practice, right, this might make no sense. What's the grass? What's 10,000 miles? What is he talking about, right? But when you have a koan like this, you know, the answer, we Zen people believe the answer to every koan is right here in front of you. Think about your own practice, right? So in this case, you know, to be in a place where there's no grass means that you can access, you can get to that deep samadhi. And in that deep samadhi, you know, it's really transformative. It's like on day three of our meditation retreats, you know, you come to Sesshin on day one, all of this stuff from your life is haunting you. You know, day two, you're getting tired. Day three, it's like the things that bothered you seem so remote and unimportant. You know, it's a little bit like when you go on, just before you go on vacation, right? Everything at work seems terribly, overwhelmingly difficult. Then you go on vacation, maybe you go for a hike in the mountains, and on day three you realize, I don't care, you know, it's not important. Having that distance is really liberating. And on the cushion, that happens to you too, right? You know, you come in to sit down, and with practice, you can get into deep samadhi, and then, you know, you're free from that, the grip of those from those events, right? So Dongshan is saying, look, you monks are heading out into the world. You're going home now for the break, for the intercession. And, you know, you're going to get home, and the first thing that's going to happen to you is you're going to meet your brother and your sister, and the first thing that's going to happen is within an hour you're going to get into an argument with them, because you always do, right? And they'll do something that annoys you or that seems unfair. And remember your samadhi power. Remember when it starts to eat away at you, right? Get, you know, sit down, say, thank you, it's lovely to see you. And then go sit down somewhere quietly, watch your breath, and enter deep samadhi. And when you enter deep samadhi, those responses, those things that happen to you stop bothering you. Okay. So that's what he's saying. You monks and nuns, don't forget that you can go to the place where there is no grass, right? There's no grass. It's clear and open always. So that's the first part of the koan. And if you don't know how to go to the place where there is no grass, the koan won't make any sense. And what you could do is just say no grass. You know, koans work by on a deeper level. They activate your unconscious. You could say your enlightened unconscious mind, which we can't always access very easily. So when you say something like no grass, no grass, no grass, you sit down on the cushion and you say no grass on each out breath, for a long time, nothing happens. And you're sitting there thinking, why am I saying no grass? This is the stupidest thing in the world. But, you know, eventually that koan goes down, down, down into your unconscious, into your big mind, and it begins to trigger a reaction, which is actually fairly predictable, you know. And even if you haven't gotten into deep samadhi very often, sometimes just working with this koan can push you into deep samadhi. You might just be sitting there for 3 days saying, no grass, no grass, no grass, and then all of a sudden it's like, whoa, this place is so clear, it's so unmoving. See? And you go in to see the teacher in Dokusan, you say, what's going on? I feel like I'm in this imperturbable place. See, and the teacher would say, well done, you know, you've really worked on your koan. You've really processed your koan in a deep way. So that's the first, excuse me, that's the first part of the koan. But there's more to the koan than this, see? The second and third parts of the koan is, but where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles, how can you go? See, this is more complicated, right? when you get into deep samadhi, when you can get into deep samadhi, that is not enlightenment. And it's life-saving, but it's not enlightenment. And if you stay in deep samadhi, if you become, you could say, addicted to being in that clarity and stillness, you can't make progress you can't progress towards deeper state, towards awakening, complete awakening. You know, that stillness and that peacefulness and that groundedness, though essential, is not enlightenment. And you can find yourself actually clinging to that beautiful state of samadhi. There was a Japanese teacher named Hasegawa who used to call that the cave of poison grass, right? He must know about this koan. But it's, you know, you go into the cave of poison grass and the grass is sweet. You're like a cow that goes into the cave of poison grass and eats the sweet grass and never leaves the cave, right? So, you know, if you can get into deep samadhi and you get addicted to deep samadhi, you're sitting on your cushion at home and you're in a blissful state and somebody knocks at the door, it's UPS and they need you to sign something and you get up and you're furious. It's like, you bastard, you've ruined my beautiful sit, right? So when you have that kind of response, you know that you're not able to work with the world. So you're not able to take that stillness and that clarity into the world of form. And the reason you can't take that stillness and clarity into the world of form is that you haven't freed yourself from your inner grass, your inner obstacles, okay? So you know, in the United States today, mindfulness is a very popular practice where people sit down on the cushion and they focus on the present moment until they become, actually we in Zen would say, until they enter samadhi, right? Till they enter an imperturbable state. but, you know, actually that is not liberation because you have all of this baggage in your mind that's still affecting the way you process experience. So, you know, you have a conscious mind, and when you sit down on the cushion and you walk, you work with the koan, you come right up to the edge of the conscious mind's, you come to the interface between the conscious and the unconscious mind, see? When you get to that blank, still place in yourself, that's like the door into the unconscious mind. But, you know, in your unconscious mind, you have stored up all of these conditioned responses that you've picked up throughout your life, right? So these are not visible to the conscious mind, but you're carrying them with you. And whenever you experience the world, they color your experience. And they're not visible, but they influence what we do all the time. So, you know, I've talked about this before, but when I was growing up, at one point, my family lived in Baltimore, Maryland. If you know Baltimore, it's actually kind of a tough, gritty city. It makes, you know, it makes New York look very gentle and refined, in my opinion. And when I was growing up in Baltimore, you know, there was a lot of violence. It wasn't like shootings, you know, but when I would go to school every day, I had to be careful not to get beaten up by the older kids. I used to have to walk from our apartment complex to York Elementary School. And it must have been, I don't know how long, you know, it took me half an hour to get there. But every day I would think, how can I avoid getting pushed around by these bigger boys? And the bigger boys would grab little kids like me, and they'd knock us in the head and try to shake us down for like our lunch money, you know? And I was afraid to tell my teacher. I was afraid to tell my mother, you know, because I didn't want to escalate the conflict with these people. And I had friends of mine who had the same experience. We'd all get together, we'd walk together, so that maybe the bigger kids wouldn't shake us down. So, you know, every day going to school was kind of like a little mini trauma for me, you know? And sometimes I would get, some guy would grab me by the lapel and hit me in the head. And I'd give him my lunch money, right? One time I gave this kid my pocket knife. You know, I had like a pocket knife. My mother said, "Where's your pocket knife?" And I said, "Oh, I must have dropped it. I didn't have the nerve to tell her I gave it to somebody so he wouldn't beat me up." Well, you know, this experience colored my social interactions for like 30 years, right? I am still in some ways, even today, you know, sort of like that little kid trying to get to York Elementary School without getting beaten up. And in certain situations, I become very withdrawn and passive. And it's like, if I can just steer through this, I won't get beaten up. So, you know, when I got my PhD, I had to go out on the job market and go to interviews. And, you know, if you're in my business, it's like a committee interviews you. So you go into a room and a group of people, there's like three or four professors, will talk to you about your research. And, you know, basically these interviews take place at hotels at big conferences. So you go to a conference, you have a room number, you're supposed to come to that room in the Hyatt at 11 o'clock. You go in and you sit down and they ask you questions about your work. And the first year I went out on the job market, I didn't get a job. And my dissertation director called some of the people who interviewed me and he said, "What was wrong with Spellmeyer? What happened with Spellmeyer?" And they said, "He was so passive," right? So I came into the room and I was thinking, these people are going to beat me up. Not literally, right? I didn't think they would literally beat me up, but I felt like I was about to get beaten up. And I did my old trick. I became very passive and waited for them. They said he never took the initiative. He waited for us to ask the questions. He waited for us to say something to him, and then he'd respond and then sort of like retreat. You know, so the second time I went out on the job market, the second year, my dissertation director and I had rehearsed interviewing. And so I was on the offensive. I was definitely outgoing. And I could work against my conditioning, right? but those habits we carry with us through life. And often they're invisible. So they're invisible. I was lucky that I had friends, my mentor called his friends and said, Spellmeyer seems like he could have gotten this job. Why didn't he get the job? And they said, he's too passive. So, you know, fortunately, my friends helped me to see my conditioned response, right? Once I understood it, it made sense to me. They didn't say, "Oh, this is because you were beaten up as a kid," but I knew I was beaten up as a kid. Okay. So, you know, actually, a lot of Zen practice is involves uncovering and working through these stored up conditioned responses in ourselves. So, you know, when the teacher gives you a koan, you know, it may seem like an innocuous phrase, like, how can you go? See? So if you answer the first part of the koan, you come into the teacher and you say, I'm getting into this imperturbable state, see? The teacher will say, very well done, but there's a second part to this koan. Now I want you to do, how will you go? And you give that to the student, and the student might begin to just sit on the cushion for a couple days saying, how? Or how will you go? How will you go? How will you go? And you know, one day the student may come in to see the teacher in Dokusan and just be overcome with sadness or furiously angry, right? And so what's happening is that the koan is bringing out some kind of conditioned response that is not visible to the discriminating mind. And you know, I've definitely had given people koans and had them come into the Dokusan room, and they've just been furious at me. Right? I once had this person come in, and he was just yelling at me. Right? You know, you bastard! You and he made some derogatory comments about my appearance. You know, and so on. It really wasn't nothing personal, right? It's stuff that he was dealing with that he hadn't dealt with, right? So you know, if you cling to the grassless state, that serenity and that purity, you can't begin to work through the obstacles that are in our school of Buddhism. We call this the storehouse mind. The unconscious is the storehouse mind. So, you know, the storehouse mind is full of stuff that we haven't processed. And a lot of Zen practice is confronting that. You can't work it through until you can get into deep samadhi, until you can be in that dark, that blank, still state. But then, you know, you're working through your obstacles. And every time you encounter an obstacle and you work through it, it's like your world becomes a little bigger. It's like a little bit of an opening. And, you know, we all begin our lives like an open hand. But then, you know, life does stuff to us, right? And we start closing up. And so if you're not very careful, by the time you're 40 years old, you're a very tight fist. And then it's very hard to grasp anything with a closed hand, yeah? So a lot of Zen practice is learning, first of all, just to relax, you know, and then open the hand. And working through our karma, the karma or conditioned responses stored in our storehouse mind is the most important element of Zen practice. And, you know, it's definitely a great shame if people just practice to get temporary relief from their stress. You know, one of the things that worries me about the mindfulness craze in the United States is that people are just sort of grooving on stillness, and they're not unpacking their karmic obstacles. They're not even getting close to them. And it's difficult to do that, right? It's difficult to do that because it means confronting old wounds or, you know, things that have, you know, we closed the doors on those things to protect ourselves. And now Zen is opening those doors back up, and it's challenging sometimes. You know, much harder than the pain in your legs at Sesshin is facing your obstacles, right? But when you dissolve an obstacle, when you work it through, it's like suddenly you can see a little bit. You can see through that hole in the wall. And we keep opening it up and opening it up and opening it up. When people talk about enlightenment, you know, people think, if you don't know much about practice, you know, people think, you know, you're sitting on the cushion one day and all of a sudden the sky opens up and the light pours in and that's enlightenment. But it's actually not like that. What really has to happen is you have to, you do it, you know, basically step by step, you know, and you open it up a little bit and you open it up a little bit. So, you know, the ideal situation when you're practicing Zen is to be in a blank state. Basically, if you can rest serenely in that state and you're working with your koan, you begin to have encounters with your inner obstacles. Stuff comes up. It's like you throw the koan into the well of your mind and it sinks out of sight. And nothing is happening, but then all of a sudden something comes out of the well. It may be an unwelcome stranger, but you have to deal with it, right? It may be Bobby Westbrook, who used to beat me up in Baltimore. And there's Bobby Westbrook. He's been in there for 50 years, you know. But when you work through your Bobby Westbrooks in life, you walk a little, you breathe, you walk. You have a much happier existence. So basically what Dongshan is saying is, look, you're going to go where there's, you know, when you go home and you encounter your brother and sister and you start arguing about who's going to get your mother's furniture when she passes away, you know, sit down on the cushion and enter deep mushin, enter samadhi, and get back to that place. But actually, the argument is really a possible way of waking up more deeply. You know, so when you sit with your feelings of maybe when you're around your brother and sister, they never listened to you, you were the junior partner, they pushed you aside, they made fun of you. You know, you sit down on the cushion and all that stuff comes up, and if you push it away, you're missing the chance to liberate yourself from those conditioned responses. So, you know, so when you're in deep samadhi and you begin to feel like anger at your brother, right, you know, you sit with that anger. And if you're able to be in that imperturbable place, you know, it's like you begin to understand the causes of your anger. You may remember the event that, you know, or events that triggered it. On the other hand, you may not, but at some point the anger just goes away and you're able to deal with your brother in a totally different way. So, you know, we need our obstacles in order to wake up. And things that bother us are like precious opportunities to liberate ourselves, right? And so it's very important to, you know, to be taking advantage of these things in life that bother us. The things in life that bother us are the doors into an awakened mind. And the bigger the challenge, the bigger the opportunity to wake up. So when you feel, when you are working with feelings of loss or missed opportunities, those are painful to confront, but so important, right? Those are all doors. In Buddhism, we say there are 84,000 Dharma doors. 84,000 Dharma doors. And you read that and think, what does that mean, 84,000 Dharma? It means every obstacle can be a door. And actually, every door, if you cling to it, if you hold on to it, can become an obstacle. But every obstacle is a door into your bigger mind, into your big mind, right? And in Zen practice, we work through this obstacle, and then this obstacle, and then this obstacle. And, you know, several years down the road or a decade down the road, you're a very different person. Your interactions with the world are very different. And then the last part of this koan is this exchange. Shi Shuang says, going out the gate immediately there's grass. And Dayong says, I'd say not even going out the gate, the grass is boundless. You know, in Zen tradition, there is something called Great Mirror Samadhi. Great Mirror Samadhi. And you'll see that phrase in the sutras and you'll wonder what it is. But, you know, at first, we are so preoccupied with our mental events that we can barely be present in the world. So, you know, if you've gotten some bad news at work and you come home and somebody's talking to you, you might say, what was that? I didn't even hear you, because you're so caught up in the things in your head, right? And that is basically a common situation, right? The mental phenomena are making it impossible for us to respond to the world around us. So you could put it this way, you know, this is a little bit bizarre, but behind your eyes, there's a screen, like in a movie theater, right? And in front of your eyes is the world, right? I don't know if that makes any sense, but you're looking through your eyes at the world, and in your head, there's a movie theater. So, you know, when you have a bad day and you come home and your dog is barking at you, your eyes are looking at the dog barking at you, but on the movie screen in your head, your boss is going, this report is not acceptable, right? So the dog is yelling at you, your beloved dog, and in your head, in the movie screen, the boss is going, this report is not acceptable. So you turn and you yell at the dog. And then you go in the house and think, why did I yell at him? I love him. And he's hurt, you know, his tail is between his legs, and you think, what a monster I am, right? So this is a common situation. It's like the screen in your head is not clear, right? And your responses to the world are constantly conditioned by what's going on in the screen in your head. Sometimes what's on the screen in our heads behind our eyes is not visible to us, but it's still shaping our responses to the world. So one way to think about Zen practice is that we're cleaning up the screen behind our eyes, right? So when we get rid of all our conditioned responses, all our karma, behind our eyes is just luminous and clear. And in front of us, there's just the world, see? This is how an enlightened person experiences the world. So, you know, you're looking through your eyes at the world and the screen is just bright and blank. That's an ideal state. That's an enlightened state. And so, you know, when you respond to things, you're not responding from a place of fear or attachment. You know, and actually, when you're in that state, everything is perfect. You know, everything is perfect. See, you know, this happens to people when they come to our meditation retreats. You know, by day four of Sesshin, you know, you get up and you walk outside during the break period and you're walking around Murray Grove and everything seems so pure and beautiful and alive. See? And that's because the screen behind your eyes, so to speak, is luminous and blank, or dark and blank. It's dark and blank until you have your Daikensho, and then it's luminous and blank. So there's a change in the way you experience your screen. But, you know, you have like this unmediated or unfiltered experience of the world, and even like blades of grass seem gorgeous, or, you know, the sound of cars on US 9. It sounds so beautiful, right? And it's because you've cleaned up the screen behind your eyes. So everything becomes enlightened mind for the person in this state. Everything becomes what Buddhism calls the pure land, the pure land. You know, so if you're in a distressed condition of mind, you can be on the beach in Kauai and miserable, right? And, you know, if you can clear up the screen behind your eyes, you know, you can be in the worst situation. And, you know, it's all rice. It's all nourishment for you, right? You know, everything becomes the pure land if you can clean up the screen behind your eyes. So if you talk to somebody, does Zen and they're from another community and you say, yeah, our teacher told us about the screen behind our eyes, they won't know what you're talking about. Okay, so this is my personal explanation, but I think it's a good one. So, introduction, move and you bury your body 10,000 feet deep. Don't move and sprouts grow right where you are. Well, we're all not moving on the cushion, right? You must cast off both sides and let the middle go. Then you must buy some sandals and travel some more before you attain realization. So on the cushion and off the cushion, we're practicing, right? Dongshan said to the assembly, it's the beginning of autumn, the end of summer, and you brethren will go some to the east, some to the west. You must go where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles. So you must be able to get into that imperturbable samadhi state. But, he also said, but where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles, how can you go? From that imperturbable samadhi state, you must embrace what perturbs you, basically. Then Shishuang said, going out the gate immediately, there's grass. In our, you know, basically there's already grass in our heads that we have to clear up, okay. Dayong said, I'd say, not even going out the gate, the grass is boundless. So in the last condition, everything becomes your rice. Everything becomes the pure land if you've cleaned up the screen behind your eyes. So that's what we're doing. You know, and it's, as the Buddha said, it's beautiful at the beginning, it's beautiful in the middle, and it's beautiful at the end. You know, it's like the final stage in your practice is incorporating everything into your pure land. Everything that bothers you can be transformed into part of this enlightened world, this beautiful, this impossibly perfect world. So we all have work to do, and everybody came here to do that work. And I thank you so much.